And our text this day, our preaching text is found in Ecclesiastes 5, 1 to 7. On page 555 of your pew Bible. Ecclesiastes 5, 1 to 7. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few, for a dream comes with much business and a fool's voice with many words. When you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. My introduction to the Orthodox Presbyterian Church occurred in September of 2000 in Portland, Oregon, where Terry Wright and I attended on behalf of the fledgling Congregation of New Geneva. The Orthodox Presbyterian received us as a mission work there, but also a young man stood for his ordination in the Presbytery of the Northwest. Not me. But it was my first experience of an ordination exam in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. I have witnessed some 35 to 40 exams over my career, and I have to confess that this one was the finest, both in terms of the questions posed and the answers given. What a great introduction to the Reformed faith and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church that was. The ordinate was confident, composed, and as thoroughly at home in the Bible and the Westminster Standards as anyone I've ever met. But what is pertinent for our message today is the economy of his speech. He answered almost every question in one or two brief, pithy sentences, using language from the Scripture or the Westminster Shorter Catechism to establish his points. He was respectful, calm, and concise. You'll see that's the title of our message today, concise. And a kind of momentum developed over the course of the exam so that by the conclusion of it, it was evident that this young man will be approved by acclamation, and he was. He embodies, even today, the proverb from chapter 17, whoever restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. I like that turn of phrase. He who has a cool spirit, and we're not talking 1950s Beat Generation cool either. We're calling a cool spirit in contrast to a hothead, right? Whoever has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Now, in contrast, I've seen the best, I've seen the worst in the OPC as well. I've also witnessed an opposite kind of ordinate. Loquacious, hasty, and ineffective he was. Let me note that it was not only his prolix style that bothered most of the men. His sermon was weak and missed the point of the text. His answers to doctrinal questions were often personal and anecdotal rather than biblical and confessional. But what, of course, is pertinent for our message today is the lack of economy in his speech. Once he sensed that he was in deep, hot water with the men of the presbytery, his answers grew longer and fuller in an attempt to extricate himself from an ever-increasing quagmire. What he failed to realize is that the more he spoke, the more he revealed himself to be unfamiliar with the text and the confession. The more he spoke, the longer he took to answer a question, the more reckless in his speech he became, and the more irritated we became. his gaining of ground with us bore an inverse relationship to the amount of words he used. This man stood before us on three separate occasions, each time reprising his previous performance, poor fellow, each time being rejected as a minister in the OPC, embodying the proverb, "Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There is more hope for a fool than for him." These two men are a metaphor, if you will, for the point Koheleth desires to make with us today. That is, as a creature made in God's image, we are under constraint to use words as he does, truly, sincerely, and concisely. Well, I've made my point. If I'm true to my word today, can't we all go home now? I've made my point. If only, huh? There are a few more things that must be added to establish this point from our text for the gospel today. So, let me take you to two points. The inside flap of your bulletin, you have those points made for you. Concise. When you come before the throne of God, be silent and or concise. Our words are not like the word. Pertinent and omniscient overall, so use them economically. Up to now, as we have been going through Ecclesiastes, we have traversed the gamut of human activity. The house, the field, the mountain, waters of the sea, the table, the court of the king, and many, many others, haven't we? Now we see a change because we see a change of venue. The house of God, the temple in Jerusalem. Do you remember the metaphor for that realm of the lower register, that is the physical, visible realm? It is, of course, all of those things under the sun that we have been looking at. Well, now, we are ushered into a place of a different order, the house of God, a place where we enter the presence of one who is from the upper register, the place above the sun. Do you sense the fear of the Lord, the change in tone, the fear of the Lord implicit in Koheleth's words? Guard your steps, he says. Guard your steps when you go into the house of God. What happened to Nadab and Abihu, who offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them, back in Leviticus chapter 10, you remember? They should have been more guarded. Fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. What happened to Uzzah when he put out his hand to stabilize the Ark of the Covenant? Remember when David was bringing it up from the house of Abinadab to Jerusalem? He should have been more guarded in his steps. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error, and he died there beside the Ark of God. This is the sense Koheleth wishes to bring to us, the fear of the Lord. Time and again, we're cautioned to guard our steps when dealing with an all-holy, all-consuming God who is not like us. Do not think to yourselves that God is like us. So behold and beware, dear listener. He is not like you. He is not like me. He is not like us. Note the reason for caution as well in verse 2. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. This is a direct indication of what we have alluded to before. That is, Solomon is primarily concerned with the brevity of life under the sun, is he not? A mist, a vapor, rather than vanity, right? Rather than vanity or meaninglessness, as some translations have it. But from time to time he will overtly and explicitly speak of that place above the sun. It will come around in cycles again, as in all life, right? He's been saying life is cyclical as well. What has been will be. What has gone will come again. So this theme will come again as well. Now the scene set is of a worshiper upon pilgrimage to the temple, newly constructed by whom? By Solomon, right? By Koheleth. Virtually all of Israel would be able to identify with this scene put forth before us by Koheleth. On they would travel en route to Jerusalem and the temple, and as roads began to converge, more and more pilgrims would fill the highways and the byways as they approached Jerusalem. And families, individuals, their pack animals and animals brought for sacrifice would be milling about, jostling one another on the road to Jerusalem. Conversations would be had and overheard. What would a traveler have heard on his way besides small talk about the hot weather, perhaps, and the dust churned up by all the people? Thieves and robbers were an ever-present danger on the roads at that time, especially during feast times. The parable of the Good Samaritan is a good example. Perhaps that wise pilgrim would recall the Proverbs from chapter 1, "Come with us. Let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. For their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. For in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird, but these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own souls." On that road with the other pilgrims, perhaps a braggart boasted of his conquests on the way, perhaps seeing that prostitutes plied their trade during festivals, or of his acquisition of some treasure or other, since merchants sold their goods, whether they be stolen or legitimate. We have evidence that gamblers cast the lot, enticed pilgrims with their various games along the way. I think of this every time I drive by Fort Hall on the way down to Pocatello. There were multiple opportunities for sin along the way, just as there are on the road for all of us, are there not? But the wise pilgrim would also recall, desire without knowledge is not good, and whoever makes haste with his feet misses his way. And from Proverbs chapter 4, ponder the path of your feet. Good advice for all of us. Ponder the path of your feet. Then all your ways will be sure. Do not swerve to the right or to the left. Turn your foot away from evil. Linger at any truck stop along the highway and you'll hear such things, right? The words of fools as well as the wise. Is there not great irony that on the way to make sacrifice for sins committed, sin is multiplied? Is it not ironic that on the way to acknowledge that one's speech has been rash and prolix, one increases the burden? Hanging over this entire section are Proverbs like Proverbs 10:19. When words are many, transgression is not lacking. Isn't that a good one? Haven't you seen that played out? If not in your own life, and the lives of other fools around you. When words are many, transgression is not lacking. I'm grateful for and I take advantage of my membership at Apple Athletic. It has allowed me to stay relatively fit without punishing my feet and knees. But one of the drawbacks is the noise pollution in the locker room created by all the heroes at drinking wine, the garrulous gamblers, the loquacious ladies' men, the bragging bench pressers and bicyclists, and the pseudo-intellectuals who keep their beer bellies hoisted up to their chest with spandex while holding their breath on the exercise floor, but who look like the before photos at the fat farm once they exhale in the locker room. When words are many, transgression is not lacking. And I'm pushing the limit on that one myself, aren't I? It is a reminder every day of Jesus' admonishment. I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. Dear brothers and sisters, we are created in the image of God. The Imago Dei. And as such, we reflect that living word. This is why this is so crucial and important in our lives. We reflect the living word made in his image by which the worlds were created, that is, by the word. We are the only creatures created who are capable of speech. The implications are then, therefore, vast and deep. We are sentient beings who think and feel and have souls. As such, we are able to express those innermost contents of our hearts. We are able to communicate simple and complex thoughts. In order to create everything from scones to skyscrapers, rickety paper airplanes to deep space rocket probes, aren't we? We can speak and do good and evil with our words. Make clear or cloudy the will and word of our Creator. Ominous and portentous it is for us. In short, how did God create man, our standards ask? God created man, male and female, after his own image, in knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. That's how we were created, with dominion over the creatures. And the fool does not take these things to heart. He speaks brashly from his own proud and sinful heart. The wise man knows he is created in the image of his Maker, the Word, and as such, his words should reflect him. He knows this. Do yours. Do yours, brother and sister. How humbling it is it not, when we consider our own performance in the past week? What if we could go back over our week to weed out and reform our words? What if we had that opportunity every week? What would that leaf bag of weeded words look like? What would yours look like? How full would it be? What would be left of solid, righteous speech that will stand the test on the day of judgment? Brings us all to a moment of silence, does it not? Well, know that while our little thought exercise here is sobering, perhaps, something of this sort is in store for every living soul here today on the day of judgment. Koheleth exhorts us, therefore, to ponder and fear. Both of our sections end with then a concluding dream aphorism, as it's called, a dream aphorism, a saying concerning a dream. For a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. These lines express a Hebrew parallelism. That's how Hebrew poetry works. Thoughts in parallel rather than words rhyming. The dream with much business is like a fool with many words. Koheleth is alluding to the theme of Ecclesiastes here as well, the relative brevity of our deeds and our efforts. It is a theme throughout the wisdom literature. The fool does not take it to heart either. Job 20 in verse 8, for example, he says, he, the fool, that is, he flies away as a dream, so they cannot find him. Just like a vision in the night, he vanishes. Such is the fate and the lot of the fool. Therefore, what remains is for us to measure our words every time we approach the temple, i.e. the presence of God in the Lord Jesus Christ, here assembled in worship, for example. What remains for us is to measure our words, to make them few, pithy, and concise. And as we do, we find ourselves gaining wisdom and living in the righteous image of our Maker. Psalm 5, verses 4 and 7 say, you are not a God who delights in wickedness. Evil may not dwell with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. Once again, the boastful with words. You hate all evildoers. You destroy those who speak lies. Once again, speech and words. The Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. But I, through your abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house. I will bow down towards your holy temple in the fear of you. Koheleth exhorts this upon us as we approach then the temple, the presence of God. So keep this in mind when you give your word, dear brothers and sisters. That brings us then to verses 4 to 7. Concise. Approaching the presence of God should make us silent or very concise. Our sworn will is not like Yahweh's. Our sworn will is not like Yahweh's. High and sure above all else. So, humbly say and then do accordingly. In the ancient world, the temple was the place to pay what one vowed. Foreign to us, in that day, a vow was a sacred promise by oath to pay a designated specific sacrifice unto God. Generally for prayer that was answered, or blessings received, or worshipful acknowledgement of God's goodness to the worshiper. It was utterly voluntary until it was made. Then it became obligatory with great penalty for its negligence or failure to pay. Deuteronomy 23, if you remember, we were in Deuteronomy a while back. Deuteronomy 23, verses 21 to 23, where it says, "If you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin." You see, this is entirely voluntary. No sin for not vowing, but once you vow. Verse 23 says, "You shall be careful to do what has passed your lips. For you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth." Speech, words. The word made living. We are creatures of speech. We reflect the image of our Maker and our Creator, the Word. So He requires responsibility for our words as well. At the heart of the vow is once more the word, the sworn word of a man made in the image of God. This is why God takes the giving of one's word so seriously, and why it is a matter of character to be a man of your word. To swear an oath was to bind oneself to the payment of the vow on penalty of hurt to himself if he does not. Implicit in it is that with God as witness, God will exact this hurt through his divine providence if the oath maker reneges or slights the payment of the vow. And the fool does not weigh the gravity of this circumstance. Proverbs 20 and 25 says, "It is a snare to say rashly, 'It's holy,' i.e., I'm dedicating X, Y, or Z unto the Lord as a vow. 'It is a snare to say rashly, 'It is holy,' and to reflect only after making vows." Does that resonate with you? You reflect only after you've made a vow or any obligation. How often have we done this? Applied for that student loan, leaving it in the dustbin after graduation, never intending to pay it back. It's only government money after all. Or maybe we've maxed out a drawer full of credit cards, never intending to pay them, but settling maybe, perhaps, much later. Or vowed to be true to one's spouse in every circumstance, crossing one's fingers behind his back even as the ring goes on the other finger, huh? Or signing a contract, an agreement of any sort, with no intention of honoring it to its fullest intent or not at all. We know this in our world, don't we? America is rife with it. The more we humans fail in this regard, in our word, being men and women of our word, the more contracts and paper and lawsuits and lawyers we seem to need in order to enforce our sworn word. Hosea reflects on this in chapter 10 of his letter. "They utter mere words. With empty oaths they make covenants," i.e. contracts. "Therefore lawsuits spring up like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field," he says. Dear listener, our field of promises are full of poisonous weeds, are they not? But God listens. And in his divine providence, he will exact a price for word broken. In ancient Israel, the high priest sent out a Levitical messenger. That's what he refers to here in our text. When the messenger comes around, and you say, I didn't really mean it, right? Well, in ancient Israel, the high priest sent out a Levitical messenger into the cities and villages of the land to collect upon the vows made. If he appeared at your door and you made excuses, so surprised to see you. Sorry, I was only kidding. I didn't mean it. Really? I forgot. Maybe next week. And if he did this, they sent out Sal and Vito with their rubber hoses to exact payment, perhaps with interest. I embellish a little bit, but it's unclear exactly how these things played out historically. But the righteous man understood that God would providentially judge one as righteous and wise, or wicked and a fool for the rash vow. This is implicit in Kohelet's statement here. Why should God be angry at your voice? Focusing once again on a man's word. Why should he be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Now, we have been seeing all through Kohelet, all through Ecclesiastes as well, the idea that a man builds up his estate, does he not, with his hands, with his labor? This comes under threats in the broken vow. Dear listener, what would it be for us if God were like us, half-hearted in the fulfillment of his sworn word? Where would we be? This should compel us to be men and women of our word, brothers and sisters, and be a demonstration for our culture around us, which is sinking swiftly, isn't it not? Is it not in its broken word? But God, fortunately, thank him, is not like us, is he? In Genesis, he promised Abraham. Genesis 22, verses 15 to 18. And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn. Sometimes we read over those rather quickly, don't we? By myself I have sworn, God said. Declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. And I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because of you have obeyed my voice. God swears by himself. He can swear by nothing higher, as the author of Hebrews reflects for us. Is that not so? Where would we be without the sworn will of our faithful God? What if he were like us? Where would we be? We would still be in our sins, would we not? Fallen and failed. But thank him, he is not like us. Behold the sworn word of your God. Back to Hebrews. Let's go back to Hebrews a moment. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. The author of Hebrews is driving home the point that God has been faithful to all of his promises, sworn by himself to be faithful to all of those promises meticulously, punctiliously. He has been. You are sitting here today as a regenerate Christian because he has been faithful to those promises. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves. We call God as our witnesses in holy oaths, do we not? When we baptize our children, when we take membership in a church, that you are swearing before God. I submit to you, a lot of people take the oath of membership very lightly in these days. But you are swearing before God, by God. For people swear by something greater than themselves. And in all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. He is saying here, because God is faithful to His Word, you have something to cling to hope for. You have an utterly reliable track record by your God of His fulfilling all of His promises fully, beyond our expectations, once they come flooding over us. Who would have expected and anticipated the blessings of life in Christ, in the church? Blessings beyond our comprehension. This is your hope. You have a hope set before you. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul. As I grow older and see God's faithfulness in my life, in the life of my family, what a rejoicing it is. How sure and steady, what an anchor it is. What a surety it is. A steadfast anchor of the soul. A hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf. We're on our way there. Some of us know we have relatives and friends and loved ones that have gone on before. We have this hope. Christ has gone on before. Others have gone on before as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And then he gets started on a theme with the order of Melchizedek, where indeed he is a priest, a living priest, an eternal priest, is he not, Melchizedek? Not as the LDS have shamefully made the Melchizedek priesthood into something it is utterly not. This priesthood belongs to Christ and to Christ alone. A high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, and because he is that priest, you have life as well, promised to you as a sure anchor and a sure hope. So in days to come, as you approach the temple each week, i.e., the living Christ, God in the living Christ, as you come to worship each Sunday, take Koheleth's advice. Ponder these things. Ponder these things in silence and make your thoughts and your feelings many and your words few. Let us now then come to that place in reverence where we find our God emblemized,